Blog Talk Radio. Delighted to welcome you here today for another wonderful show with a truly wonderful guest. And I am so looking forward to bringing on the line in just a moment Stuart Pierce, who is so graciously returning to the show. And I am just so very honored and blessed when he is here, because he really is a true agent of change in our world. He is the author of multiple books. He is an angelic visionary, a sound healer, and a voice coach who has worked with absolutely remarkable people such as Princess Diana and Vanessa Redgrave and many, many others. And today we are going to really flow with exploring the heart space with Stuart, reflecting wisdom from, I'm sure, much of his work, including his book, Angels and the Keys to Paradise, Ancient Egyptian Codes to Open Your Door to Heaven, and also his highly acclaimed book, The Alchemy of Voice, Transform and Enrich Your Life Through the Power of Your Voice. I also have in front of me some oracle cards from Stuart. He has produced multiple decks, and I am known to bring these decks with me to expos, as some of you know who have stopped by my booth. And just a little bit more about Stuart and his wonderful career as a voice coach. He was head of voice at the Webber Douglas Academy from 1980 to 1997 and master of voice at Shakespeare's Globe from 1997 to 2008. And he speaks worldwide, and I was just delighted to see him at the Los Angeles Conscious Life Expo recently speaking. His websites, he has more than one, thealchemyofvoice.com, theangelsofatlantis.com are a couple. And I am just so very, very delighted to bring Stuart Pierce back onto the air. Hello, Stuart. Welcome.
Well, my darling, how lovely to speak to you. And just sitting here, I'm blushing, listening to all of these wonderful appellations that you're attending to me. And I didn't know that you were in L.A. for the Conscious Life Expo.
Yes, I was there. I had a booth, and I just was so delighted to see many of the people there who have come on this show, and I know it was a delightful time for everyone. So anyway,
it was such fun, wasn't it? I wish I'd known.
Was.
I would have come to say hello.
Well,
anyway, here we are saying hello.
Yeah. Yes, it's wonderful to speak to you, Stuart. And you know what I find so really refreshing about you, Stuart, is I remember the first time you came on the show, I felt a little bit nervous because, you know, here comes this voice coach. I mean, just a phenomenal person. And then I remember reading somewhere in your book about not worrying about assessing of voices or something like that. And it's just very much our hearts, isn't it? That's what matters. It's our heart.
Yeah. The heart is the seat of the soul. what else is there?
Yeah.
Well, what else is there is duality, and we've been spending a lot of time living just in our heads with a tremendous amount of information that has supported the fact that cerebralization or intellectualization through academia is the most significant thing, and now we're all waking up to the fact that it's not. That it is important, obviously, to have an agile, elastic, flexible mind, particularly by the way that we think, because thought creates reality. But if we're not balancing it with our hearts, if we're not balancing it with our souls, then, well, I was about to say, heaven knows what will happen. But of course, we know what happens, because all we need to do is to look at the world and see the exclusive arguments that are taking place in the world, where people just simply compete, because they're not living in their hearts, recognizing that we're all in this together, hence the essence of co-creativity. So what else is there but the human heart? Absolutely, it is the seat of the soul.
Yes, yes. I love how I was just reading about how you were talking in one of your books about being versus doing. And it seems if we get too wrapped up in doing, that's when we feel so uncomfortable. That's when we feel we're being assessed. That's when we feel we're not really in the space of the heart. And yet you talk of this notion of being and how that really matters.
Yes, well, I mean, we're fixated by doing, because we've been conditioned, educated, socialized, seduced maybe into just doing. And of course, we go into some very significant areas of our world, and doing is the fixation that impinges on everybody's consciousness, because that's the way that mechanistically we need to be aligned. And as a result of that, in terms of my work as a voice coach, that what actually happens if we're just doing is that we're spending most of our time just living in the head. And of course, when we live in the head, what we tend to do is to produce a sound that is purely to do with head orientation or cerebral orientation. And you can hear how radical my voice has just become. I mean, it shifted completely, and I'm going to stop doing this in a minute, because otherwise a lot of people who are listening are going to switch off. So what I'm going to do is go back down into my body, into my heart, and automatically there's a great shift of energy. So I move from cerebralization into the quality of my integrity. In other words, what I've done is to readjust myself into feeling an integration of the physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual energies. And, of course, where the center is right in the middle of our being. Now, when I say right in the middle of our being, I don't mean within the solar plexus. Otherwise, we'd be talking very deeply like this. But if we come up into the heart area, which is just above the solar plexus, we can find a very comfortable regime, a very comfortable realm for us to literally vibrate all of our creativity from. And this is when we move into harmony. And of course, when we move into harmony, every aspect of our being, physically, emotionally, mentally, and spiritually, comes into alignment. We come back into coherence. And when we're in harmony, of course, the one thing that we want to do is to dispense love and joy wherever we go, because they are the constituent parts of harmony. If we're in disharmony, we know exactly how to shift our disharmonies into harmony by bringing harmony into disharmony. And if that includes disease, we can do the same thing. We can move from dis-ease into ease. And then we start feeling a sense of our own power. And by feeling our own power, we move into our sovereignty, where the king, queen within, the male, female within, balances itself, or balances themselves, these two different aspects of our being, the left and right brain, the yin and the yang, the doing and the being, the effort and the free, the dynamic and the still, come together in the central fulcrum of our being. And, you know, from all that I've experienced over quite a considerable amount of time, 40 years worth of professional life, that actually, this is a very ancient precept. There's nothing new about this. This is what many of our societies or cultures lived, breathed, believed in, resonated, and taught for many, many hundreds of years particularly within the period that we refer to as classicism. So, you know, for example, if we go to the Roman world, which came just after the Greek civilization, there was a very strong belief in the fact that we all had something called persona. Persona means the qualities of experience that I've just been illustrating, that we're living in harmony, that we're living in the center of our beings, that we're integrated physically, emotionally, mentally, and spiritually, and therefore we're speaking from a position of integration or integrity. And they call this persona because persona literally means per, through, sona, sound, and is the root of our word personality. The difficulty is that in the early part of the 20th century, Carl Jung, who was working at that time, used the notion of persona as a social mask. In other words, a mask that was actually hiding us from our true authenticity, an assumed state of being that allowed us to be ratified within society and not necessarily a state of being where we were living the complete truth of our being, because it was just purely about ego. And now we're making those final readjustments and returning to something that the ancient Greeks and the ancient Romans were living in comprehensive and copious amounts. You know, we can go on just a little bit further. We know that, for example, there were two essential phrases, persona grata, persona non grata. Persona grata meant that you have the freedom to speak, and therefore you spoke your heart, you spoke your soul, you spoke your mind. Persona non grata meant that you didn't have the right to speak, so this presumably meant that you were a servant or a slave to your master or your mistress. They spoke for you. So to become persona grata was a real functioning status in the world, where you took full responsibility for your citizenship within society, and you spoke through the highest form of thought, which of course is noble. All the highest choices, never the lowest choices, all the highest choices. And then when we, you know, when we face the predicament of terrorism, post the Berlin Wall coming down, and the horrors, of course, of 9/11, most of those people whom we imprisoned in Guantanamo Bay were called non-persons. In other words, their voices were taken from them. The right to speak was taken because of the ghastly crimes that they'd perpetrated. Isn't that fascinating that we're returning to this wonder?
Yes. You know, I have a question for you, Stuart, in terms of using our authentic voices. I feel that so often we feel that we're in roles where we can't use our authentic voices. And I feel that, you're a true role model in this way because you are so beautifully authentic through your angelic work. You know, we may have careers where we feel like we can't fully express our spiritual beings. There are so many ways that we can feel that we are shut down from expressing our true voice. And I wonder if you could assist us, Stuart, with finding that voice and expressing it courageously, like you have.
Well, thank you. It's an interesting, certainly a very, very interesting point that you're making, and it develops into a very full thesis. And I, you know, firstly, what comes to my mind is the fact that if I have found that you suggest I've found, I'm having great fun. and I do know that when I was, you know, some years ago now, when I was a much younger man, I had not found my voice. So I was still using the sound that had been conditioned within me, which was not the sound of freedom at all. It was the sound of fear and the rhetoric of compromise. And then I developed, through the tutelage of these great light beings, these great angels who came to me in 1987, the 12 angels of Atlantis, I developed a very profound conviction and saw that the conviction brought about great change in my life. Firstly, for me personally, because life became joyous, life became free flow, life became full of abundance, life became filled with extraordinary people, and great exchanges of energy took place. And so I realized, although initially the angel said to me, look, you know, angels are not common parlance in society, particularly in certain areas of society. So I was regularly working with leading politicians in the United Kingdom there. You don't walk into 10 Downing Street talking about seeing angels. Otherwise, you've shown the door. Similarly, to a certain extent, I don't believe that angels are common parlance in the White House or in the Senate, in Congress. Although maybe I'm doing everybody a gross disservice, and that's not true.
We may be surprised.
One may be surprised. There are just degrees. I think that's what you and I are referring to, that there are just certain degrees that are either permissible or not permissible. And then I move through, because of a certain life initiation, which initially was very painful, but at the same time was immensely instrumental in me stepping forward and recognizing, what else have I got? What else have I got to say? But my utter believability in the angelic kingdom, because of the way that they've taught me and the things that I've shown, their ability to zoom in, so to speak, and produce supernatural healing on people who are gorgeous, sacred vessels, but at the same time have made inappropriate choices about their body, and as a result of that are dying of fear, which is a disease called cancer. And how they've stepped in, and because it wasn't the karma for the individual to pass during the onset of the disease moved into complete remission. And I know, I could tell you thousands of stories or hundreds of stories that I've collated over the years of witnesses like this. So I recognize that actually our world is in need of change. We can see that there are many inappropriate choices being made around the world, particularly by some of our leaders, God bless them. And we're seeing that there's a perpetuation of a downward slide within our ecology, and that, you know, there are too many people unemployed and too many people living still beneath the poverty line, whereas there are certain areas of society where very talented experts are also taking all of the profits and living with extraordinary states of abundance, rather than being charitable and allowing some of the surfeit of their income to be given to people who deserve it much more than they do. And I began to see that, you know, the only way that we can change, as Einstein said, the only way that we can change the issues in our lives, because after all, the outer space is merely a reflection of the inner space, is if we actually use a very different strategy. In other words, there's no way that we can actually resolve the problems of our lives or of the world by using the same strategy that created them. We're seeing this is not working. We need to use a new strategy. And it seems to me that the only strategy that we have open to ourselves at this moment is to move away from the cerebralized, formulaic, mechanistic belief system into heartfelt consciousness. So we move from the love of power into the power of love, because love is truly transcendent, and that's when all the magic and the miracles will take place. The angels are wanting to take us there. They're wanting to actually illuminate the conviction of what it is to become a light-filled being, so that we move from being Homo sapien into Homo luminous, so that we literally we become enlightened, because ourselves are so full of love and so full of joy, rather than full of fear and doubt and worry and guilt, that our cells are so full of love and joy and freedom and adventure, that we literally become like beacons. We become like lighthouses.
Yeah.
And so when I saw the conviction of this possibility, coupled with the fact that I needed to release myself from the establishment that I'd served for many years, that I stepped forward and the angels gave me permission to speak utterly about the dualistic function that I've been living for many years, on one hand as a voice coach, and on another hand as a mystic and an angel medium. and bring them all together. Now, I know that there are certain people who are saying Stuart Pearce is a fruitcake, and I'm not going to work with him again. But there are also lots and lots and lots of other people, you know, in terms of the law of abundance, the law of divine compensation, wherever there seems to be a void, energy always fills it with even greater abundance and mirth and happiness and love and playfulness than there ever was before.
Yes, I love that you mentioned playfulness, because I think that we get so serious. I mean, look at your career, which is just astonishing. I mean, just the gravitas, you know, of all that you've done, to say it in such a way. And yet here you are in this state of joyous being. And it's something that, you know, that's success in a way. You know, we don't think about what is true success in life. Is it our achievements, or is it our joy? And that's what you express. It comes through your voice. It comes through everything that you're doing. And I get this feeling, you know what, Stuart? I really wonder. You know, we say that people in the halls of government or, you know, wherever, maybe, you know, business executives, wherever they are, deep inside is that person. And I just want to acknowledge that these spiritual, playful beings are within us all, and that they're capable of coming out. And I think you help
I hear you,
us
and
encourage
I absolutely
that
believe.
You help us see
I absolutely
it. Yes.
Believe. Yeah, yeah. Because, you know, as you know, you've seen my bio, there have been some very remarkable people through my hands. And often they start off as being very starchy and very stiff and rather removed and autocratic. And then, of course, you know, my role as empowerer, my role as coach in helping someone with public speaking processes, one begins to realize that they may be mighty, but they're also terrified about public speaking, because the majority of people are. You know, that public speaking is one of the greatest fears that is shared by the majority of people in the West. The statistics go that more people are more terrified of public speaking than they are of dying, the termination of a major relationship, or indeed buying property. And I think on the Pacific coastline, it's shark attack, statistically. So, you know, I was given the opportunity of being privy to powerful people who weren't feeling powerful. And my job was to enable them to feel themselves back into their magnificence and make bold, rightful, majestic choices from a truly authentic space. And I, you know, the other thought that came to me about playfulness is that I have been immensely fortunate, because after all, actors are players.
Yes.
If an actor doesn't know how to play, then an actor is not an actor. And, you know, one of my particular areas of specialism, as you can see from my bio, are the classics. And so, you know, that's one of the reasons why, in meeting an extraordinary actor by the name of Mark Rylance, who became the first artistic director of Shakespeare's Globe Theatre, that's the reconstruction of the theatre that Shakespeare would have had constructed in 1597 on the south bank of London, on the south bank of the Thames, that is, directly opposite St. Paul's Cathedral. In 1997, we recreated that. I mean, it took 3, 4, 5 years to construct the building and many years to bring about the possibility of the construction of that building by acquiring the site, acquiring the materials, who's going to own this, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But there we opened this theatre, and Mark was a great believer in the substance of the human spirit, the human soul, and indeed allowed us to evoke those specialists that were called, to evoke the way that the medieval people believed, because in time of Shakespeare, there was a great belief in soul, there was a great belief in spirit, because they all believed in the anima mundi. The anima mundi is the animating principle of the universe, do you see? In other words, it's God's breath. Because they all went straight to Genesis and read, and God breathed on the surface of the waters and brought forth life. And God breathed into the nostrils of man, and man became a living soul. So if they weren't with their breath, They weren't alive to their soul. And if they felt weak, they believed that the weakness or the illness or the despair was to do with the fact that they weren't in alignment with soul. So the first thing they would do would be to go to nature. Because after all, Mother Nature is filled with God's breath. And God breathed on the surface of the waters and brought forth life. And God, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so they would go to nature and feel the pulse and the breath and the rhythm of Mother Nature's breath, breathing. And they would breathe it in themselves through praise, participation, and petition. They would breathe it in and pray and sing and chant and dance by a holy well or a beautiful, beautiful yew tree or an ash. Which may have had a statue of Mary attached to it or a crucifix, but at least they were there in nature and they felt better.
Yes.
So it's about time that we got back into this, you know, wonderful, free-flowing authenticity where we feel the lightness of life literally pulsing through every cell. You know, we have in our bodies over 100 trillion cells. It's more than all the stars in the Milky Way galaxy. All we need to do is to spend as much of our day just believing in these cells. Each one is in correspondence with each other cell. So in other words, every cell knows exactly what every other cell is doing in any given moment of time. I mean, this is astonishing when you think about it.
It truly is.
Isn't that fun?
We don't realize the cells that are so, you know, we hear this more and more, and it sounds so unlikely from a strict rationalist point of view, doesn't it? But on the other hand, it makes a certain amount of sense that our cells, I almost said souls, which you know, very much related in a way, have an aliveness to them, and
yes,
even an awareness. And we are accepting that more and more, I feel.
It feels this way, you know, that we're becoming gradually much more physically intelligent, much more emotionally intelligent. And as a result of this, because feeling is the language of the soul, we become more aware, we become quickened to the possibility of how we feel about our lives. And therefore, of course, the choices that we make move us back into a central position in our lives where we begin to recognize, wait a minute, there's something very remarkable about this person, meaning self, or that person, meaning other, that there is a level of consciousness which pervades through everything.
Yes.
And that is so.
Yes.
So for me,
and I,
you know, if I weren't within meditation, when I move into meditation, which is at least twice a day, conscious meditation, where I slow my physical rhythms down by using the breath, and I tune into stillness. I tune into the silence. And even in the middle of a raging city, we can hear silence. We just need to focus our minds, our bodies, into listening to a certain source. It may even be that we're listening to noise. And then beyond noise, there is this remarkable stillness. And then we begin to realize that within that stillness, there is a presence, and that this presence is just vast.
Yes.
In other words, what we're doing is we're feeling that within that presence is the multidimensional universe. This is the cosmic soul.
Yes. How do you assist us, Stuart, with learning to breathe? This is an area that I personally am working on. And no, I have much to learn, I say honestly. It, you know, ever since I was young, and many of us can probably say this, you know, those of us who've had trouble breathing, and I don't want to focus on trouble, it's an area of an expansion for me. And I know many ask, you know, how can we truly learn to breathe more expansively in the way that we are called to breathe?
Well, thank you. Yes, I mean, you know, it is the very essence of our lives, and yet we seem to be very unintelligent about.
Yes,
breath.
Yes.
And yet it's the first independent action that we achieve away from our mothers. You know, that we shoot out of our birth canal, And then generally speaking, we're hit. You know, so we breathe in, and then we make this big roar of life sound. And as I've noticed with those who I work with who are dying, the last thing that they do is to breathe out. And as a result of that, their soul leaves. And, you know, anyway, so there's this powerful force, this pranayama, this anima mundi. The Navajo call it the holy wind. And so, you know, why don't we just take a moment to feel what's happening in my body, so I can feel that my body literally feels better if I'm aligning my spine and if it feels grounded, if I feel the weight of my body in contact with the floor or indeed the soil. I can feel my feet in contact, and I can feel, if I'm seated, I can feel my sitting bones, my butt, against the chair, and my spine is aligned, and my shoulders are free. And then what's happening to my breath? Oh, I can feel my breath is moving in and out of my body. So why don't we just simply be with that rhythm for a moment? And just feel it moving in and out. If you feel that suddenly you're becoming tense, then all you need to do is to lift your arms up in the air and wiggle around a little bit and then drop your arms, and you'll feel yourself drop deeper within your body so it feels less tense. Because when we're tense, we feel light, and when we're relaxed, we feel heavy. We become grounded and earthed. And then why not just simply play with the breath? So as it comes in, we feel it going in even further. So it's wide and it's deep. And then we blow it out. We go as far as we can. And then we feel the need to breathe. And then we breathe in and our ribs open and the breath goes deep into our tummy and we feel as though there's a divine light within our flesh. And then blow it out again. And with each breath, we somehow drop deeper into our physical membrane, feel the need, and then breathe in. Feel the light of the breath fill your body, so every cell is resonant with that breath, and then blow it out. Go right to the end, feel the need to breathe. And when you're ready, breathe in, and again, feel the breath go wide and deep without lifting your shoulders. And then just let it go on. Humming it out. Doesn't that feel wonderful? And then we breathe in again and let it go on. And then we breathe in and we feel this juice moving in and out of our bodies, and suddenly our bodies feel really relaxed and happy and easy. Of course, if we've been using our bodies very tensely, we won't feel those things. But, you know, as we do this, every cell, which is estimated to perform about 6 trillion tasks every second, every cell is knowing exactly what each other cell is doing. You know, how does a human body think thoughts and play a piano, kill germs, remove toxins, mm-hmm. and make a baby all at the same time? Well, you see, you know, when we're doing that with our breath, the human body is actually tracking all the movement of the stars and the planets. Because our biological rhythms, the rhythm of our breath, is actually the symphony of the cosmos. Just amazing. Amazing, amazing. And yet when we first... Sorry, darling?
Oh, I was going to say the music of the spheres comes to mind.
The music of the spheres. We've just produced the music of the spheres.
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing? On that...
I feel much lighter.
That... Yeah. We can feel that sound coming right out of the middle of our chest, right out of our hearts. Hello, doesn't that feel amazing?
Yes, and I hope.
And
the
yet, what we do today is that we close the back of our tongue and we get really nasal, and then we've lost it,
as opposed to just letting the back of the tongue drop, so the throat opens, and suddenly this ease of dispatch occurs. Purely because the recovery of our breath is just really, really, really free. You know, whatever language we speak on this planet, we always have enough breath for each thought that we use. the interesting thing about that is that we can see this in literature, that we're beginning to actually write and speak in really short thoughts today, which means that our breathing becomes really short. We know this because the further we go back in history, let's say go back into the latter part of the 19th century with writers, great writers of that period, let's say Charles Dickens, you see that the sentences are much longer than the ones that we use today. And then we go back a little bit further, say 200 more years into the time of the latter part of the 1600s and then the latter part of the 1500s, and we see that Shakespeare's thought goes on and on and on. So they must have had more breath. So they must, again, it's surely that's a testament to reveal that they were more in tune with their bodies. There was a Lord Mayor of London at that time, you know, when Shakespeare first opened the Globe Theatre, all the world's a stage, who said that all silence is, or rather all speech is decorated silence. Isn't that amazing? All speech is decorated silence. Well, of course, they didn't have machines as we do, so there was a lot of stillness. The machines have created the noise, and it seems that most of us, most of the time, are in competition with the machines because the air conditioning is too loud. So we have to shout over it. Or there we are in harsh containers with a lot of people getting very excited and the acoustic is just blaring out. Or maybe there's music, and we need to really shout over the music as opposed to being deep within our breath and deep within our bodies and feeling absolute peace.
Yes. Do you feel, Stuart, that our relationship with time has something to do with it? Because everything in this world right now seems like it's all in a rush. And what's so ironic is we're living longer than ever, and yet somehow it seems like the people who, you know, wrote so beautifully and from the heart and so expressively, they had all the time in the world, it almost seems. And how does that figure into it, our relationship with time?
Yeah, I believe it's true, and it's sort of returning us to where we began our conversation, that we're all fixated with doing. And, of course, as we all know, that means that we're not doing what we could be doing because they say we're not doing what we could be doing. So we need to do extra to make sure that we're doing what we should be doing. And so we make more lists, and so we start to go even faster because, after all, there's always something to do.
Yes, that is so true.
Twice a year I take retreats to Egypt. And Egypt is the largest country in Arabia. Yes, I've been going to Egypt all the way through the revolution, and I'm still alive.
Well, that's wonderful.
It's a vast country. Well, it's just that so many people are hysterical about what's going on in Egypt. And I have never once had difficulty being there. However, the point about this illusion that I'm making is that it's a developing nation, what we used to call a third world country. And so the economy is much is depressed and much less full of equilibrium to the economy of our Western world. And therefore, there's a very large population of many people who are living under a dollar, not a dollar a day, but a dollar a week. They live off the land, and they live in rural communities that are vast throughout the spread of this great, great, great country, with the Nile going through the center. And as I drive through the country to move from one sacred temple to another, I see a lot of people, admittedly, particularly men, because it is Islam, and the men tend to live in the external culture, whereas the women and the children tend to live in the internal culture, although in the capital city of Cairo and other cities, that is gradually beginning to change with the reforms of classical Islam. However, I see many, many people just being, and being absolutely still.
Mm.
So that when they meet you, they have a stillness about them where they are untroubled about looking straight into your eyes. And when they see you, you know that your soul is meeting their soul. And the first thing they do
is smile.
Oh.
The first thing they do is show you love. They smile
yeah.
and show you fun by continuing to smile. And then the curiosity comes in, that they become curious about who you are and the acquisition of information from whom you are, because after all, the color of our skin is slightly different, and we're different, wearing different clothes, which means that we're from the West. It means we're from capitalism. And they know that there is bounty that they can actually reach out to receive from the West to change some rather dire predicaments sometimes of not being healthy
yeah.
and not being well and living in economically suppressed situations. But they are full of mirth. Anyway, it comes from this extraordinary sense of inner stillness. And they don't have around them the noise. They have sound around them, particularly twice a day or three times a day when the muezzin, the call to prayer, sounds. I find it absolutely remarkable because it's a measure of their honesty, or what we were saying at the beginning, it's a measure of our authenticity.
Yeah.
And then we refer to the way that we live our lives and how we are constantly surrounded by noise, constantly surrounded by action and the need to do, so much so that we can't even go to the bathroom without taking something to do, rather than just being the natural thing that we need to be in emptying our bodies or looking after our bodies. So we just simply need to find a way of spending much more time really enjoying what it is to be, starting off with meditation and moving into realms of gratitude, where we release the worry and we use prayer. What's the point of worrying when we can pray?
Yes. You know, what I appreciate about what you just shared with us is how in our world, we think joy is often associated with a kind of abundance that never feeds us. And yet you're talking about people who have very little, and yet they're mirthful. I love that word, mirth.
Mm.
They smile.
Amazingly so.
I mean, and
generous
and
beyond a fault.
That's abundance. You know, what we think
totally,
of as abundance
totally,
is
totally.
Not. It's not money, or not
yeah.
that alone. And you
yeah.
you express that so beautifully. And it really reminds those of us who, you know, maybe are called to travel and haven't traveled a great deal. That you know, I love how you explore the soul when you're on a journey and connect in such a way. It's not just place, it's people.
Well, you know, it's breathtaking, and particularly in cultures like Egypt and India and some other parts of the world, you see the veneration that local communities pay to Mother Nature, because their fields, their pastures, or their gardens are just so loved. They're always very well structured, immensely neat, if you can call nature neat. Everything grows in straight lines, and
uh-huh.
no chaos at all. And if there is, it's just a gentle tumbling chaos that nature loves to bring in, just to remind us of letting go of the strife.
Yeah.
But then when they come to deal with the 3D material aspect of the Western world, such as, should we say, in relation to the use of the plastic bottle, they just chuck it. They literally just throw it. They don't put
wow.
it anywhere. They throw it. And so there are large heaps of garbage just sitting there. Nobody attends to them. It's they despise it, you see. They literally despise it. And they leave it sitting there because they are in contempt of it. So it reminds them deep down of the beauty of their soul, because immediately there is an escape of fruition by going back into nature and tending the gardens or tending the soil or tending the fields or the pastures and looking after their cattle and their donkeys. Because
yeah.
these creatures also are part of the co-creativity of their environment. Isn't that extraordinary, you know? Whereas we are just so easily dismissive
of the material that's around us, and all value to such an extent. And I feel that, you know, so much of our conversation is about how can one possibly reach a level of success in life? Well,
yes.
My firm belief is that success is only measured by sustainable joy. That
yes.
if we really love what we do and do what we love, that joy just flows. And a lot of people may be listening and saying to themselves inwardly or outwardly, well, I don't enjoy what I'm doing. Then I say, get out. Get out.
Uh-huh.
Leave, resign. Just leave. But before you do, obviously, measure what is necessary to keep body and soul together. And find what your heart's desire is. Because if you do what you love and you love what you do, I can promise you that abundance will just flow in to produce further abundance. The difficulty is that we've been brought up to believe in scarcity. But when we look back to our childhood, did we ever doubt that there wouldn't be enough? There was always enough.
That's so true.
Even if we were hungry, even if there wasn't a lot of money, there was always enough of play, there was always enough of light, there was always enough of, even in wintertime, we could gather around the fire. Somehow, somebody made a fire. And if we were cold, we would just huddle together and warm each other. There was always enough energy. There is always enough. It's just that we're living duality, and if there is enough, there is also not enough. And so there is abundance and there is scarcity. The difficulty is that most of us have become fixated with scarcity. So we believe that there's not enough air to breathe. There's not
yeah.
enough soul for human beings to live on. There's not enough money. There's not enough gasoline. There's not enough love in the world. There's not enough. And actually, all of these not enoughs are merely illustrations of our own uncertain sense of self. And as soon as we actually tune back into what is most remarkable about our fellow human beings and therefore what is most remarkable about ourselves, we move back into joy, we move back into harmony, we move back into the wonderful sense of being free in the world, and automatically we are successful.
Stuart, have you found that when we're in that space of joy, I think it can be just magical how, you know, the right thing happens at the right time. Often just impossible things might occur. What is your relationship like to synchronicity, Stuart? Could you share that?
Oh, just extraordinary things happen, extraordinary things. What you've just shared I think is so beautiful because it ties us back into what I was saying about the angels wanting us to feel that the solution
yeah.
for today and tomorrow is magic and miracles.
Yeah.
And I have a story to share, which is about an experience that I had last September, where I was working a project in New York City, and my cell phone rang, and here was a client that I hadn't seen for a long time. Now, this was in September of last year, and it was during the week of the summit in New York City, where virtually every single potentate from around the world, including, of course, God bless him, President Obama, had arrived. So New York was in a frenzy, discussing all sorts of measures about how we can move forward successfully. And a client whom I hadn't seen for some time called me. My cell phone rang, and there she was, saying, could I meet her at the UN to go through a speech that she was going to be making? So I happened to be free. So a limo came and security guys came and checked me out, and I was shown into the UN, and I found this dear client's office, and we worked together, and as always, it was beautiful to see her because she's such a wonderful, wonderful woman. And we did the job, and we had great fun. And then it was time for me to leave. As I was leaving, she said to me, you know, have you ever been into the round chamber? Have you ever been in? Would you like to listen to one of the debates that are taking place? So I said, oh, sure, I've never been in. Of course, entry with her and the security official that was always with her, because they checked me out, they knew who I was easy. There's a, you know, there's a sort of flow of passage. And there we were sitting, and the debate that was being discussed was about the ecology of the planet. And there were very eminent environmentalists and ecologists and politicians and moneymakers all talking about how the planet is basically so diseased that we're just going to the edge of the cliff and we're going to fall off. And I noticed this beautiful, beautiful woman sitting about 10 rows in front of me. I noticed her because she was wearing fuchsia pink, and she was wearing the veil, so she was obviously from the body of Islam. And suddenly, at the end of this debate, she was asked to speak. So she stood up, and as she stood up, the veil that she had over her head, you know, the way that Pakistani women wear loose veil, it suddenly fell, and there was her, this beautiful jet black hair, which she just shook her head, and it was almost as though a supernova opened above her head. It was this extraordinary energy. And she put her arms in the air, having redecorated her head with her veil, and said, "Enough! I have been listening to this debate for the last 90 minutes, and I have heard nothing original. Nothing of clear interpretation has been offered about this dire straits that we find ourselves in. Surely this is the time for magic and miracles." And she talks about magic and miracles for 15 minutes.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, for me, that was the magic that you were talking about. That was the synchronicity. Because there I was, the, you know, cussing a bit because I was in downtown Manhattan. It was very difficult to get around because of this UN summit. And so, you know, it was all a little bit difficult, and everybody in Manhattan was feeling very angry as a result of it. So, you know, a lot of that was sort of in frustration, irritation. And then there I was, you know, seeking out what I truly believe in, which is not that anger matters. What matters is love. What matters is joy. What matters is magic. What matters are miracles.
Yes.
And there we were. So you see, the interesting thing that you and I are sharing is that thought creates reality and feeling brings about the actualization of what we want to create. So once we align ourselves with this, we automatically begin to create on a very magical level. We're highly creative. And all sorts of stuff starts happening where we meet people that we haven't met before or we haven't convened with for 20-odd years. Suddenly the telephone rings or we turn a corner and there they are. All sorts of extraordinary bits of information arise. The angels are very with us at this moment, so a lot of people are talking to me about the synchronistic nature of number, but suddenly they look up and the number of the bus is 44, or they look at their cell phone
and it's
4 minutes past 4 in the afternoon, or 11 minutes past 11 in the morning, or at night, or whatever. And suddenly people are finding feathers everywhere, or something that was lost is refound, etc., etc. Yep, there's a tremendous amount of action that's taking place as a result of the percolation of our consciousness, bringing us all to a real understanding of the true mirth of the universe. There is such a thing as cosmic humor.
Oh, yes, I believe that. You know, why do we not think that that is true? You know, we think we're raised in churches, many of us, that where, you know, everything's so serious regarding the divine and the angelic realm, and yet humor is incredibly angelic, isn't it?
Of course, yeah. I mean, who has ever seen an angel scowling?
So true. Well, maybe some of us have, but not in real life, though. We may have been taught that.
Would the angels scowl?
Yeah. Oh, I wouldn't believe they could. How could anyone that's a being
I was just thinking of the representations of angels, you know, which are normally stained glass windows or the great works of the Italian Renaissance or, you know, illuminated manuscripts. It's rare that we see angels scowling or looking angry. They're generally speaking, many of them have their mouths open, so they're engaged in song. The Hallelujah Chorus.
Yes.
You know, there's a wonderful, wonderful story that comes from the East, the Middle East, about creation, which we call Big Bang, of course. Interesting. not the Big Silence, but the Big Bang, 13.7 billion years ago. The story goes that God, in his or her infinite wisdom, made a statue of clay in true likeness of his or her self. And asked the soul to enter the statue of clay. And the soul refused, because the soul was free and liberated to be of its own dimension and to be everywhere at once. And so God, not deterred, God asked the angels to sing a seraphic chorus. And the soul was so enchanted that the soul agreed to enter the body of clay. And so began Adam Cadman. So began original man. Isn't that beautiful? So the angels sang us into these bodies.
Yeah.
And that's why they're with us now, because they want us to sing within our bodies and claim the freedom and the might and the magnificence of our souls, rather than weeping or complaining or being sorrowful about the so-called dramas that are going on in our lives. And I don't wish to make light of it, but happiness is a decision. It's not a condition. It's a decision.
Yeah.
I quote His Holiness the Dalai Lama. So maybe what we need to do is all start singing with the angels.
Yes, yes, yes. Well,
at the end of last year, I released a new CD, which are the soul songs of each of the 12 angels of Atlantis. Which is very easily found through my website, www.thealchemyofvoice.com. All one needs to do is to go to the recording page of CDs or MP3s, and there it is, Angelic Soul Calls. And you can hear the soul calls, and then you can be tempted to want to purchase as a download, as an MP3 from iTunes. And they're just beautiful. It's been so successful, this particular recording, that everybody's listening to 5 or 6 minutes meditation of the identity, the essence of each angel, just by using the angel's name. What I've done is to chant the angel's name, often 12 times, because there are 12 angels of Atlantis. And then we've spliced all the recordings together and made a journey out of them.
Yes. Oh, it sounds wonderful, Stuart. And you know, when it comes to time, we have literally, we're overflowing this time together, because we're racing to the end of the live show, and actually we're flowing to the end of the live show. There's no race going on here. It's just been so beautiful to hear your voice and how you teach us to sing. And I just, my heart is just filled with gratitude for you. And you're just such an astonishing, wonderful being. Thank you for being here today, Stuart.
Oh, thank you, and so are you. So thank you so much. It's a complementarity here, I think. It's been an absolute blessing and a great honor. Thank you so much, and I send much love to you as I do to the listeners.
Oh, well, thank you so much, and we feel it, and it's, you are just an expression of love, so... So thank you again for being here today.
Bless you.
Bless you. Bless you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And let me remind everyone that thealchemyofvoice.com is where to go, just as he so beautifully reminded us right here at the end of the show. And also theangelsofatlantis.com is another locale where you can learn all about Stuart Pearce. And as the live show does come to a close, let me remind people that the next show is Monday, April 13th at 11 a.m. Pacific and 2 p.m. East, Shavasti, Liberating Your Heart, very much on the same theme. A new guest coming to the show, and so I'm really looking forward to that. That's Monday, April 13th. If you're listening far in the future, 2015, I'm learning to mention the year more and more because I know people are going back in the archive. And that is 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern. And you can learn all about this broadcast at frontierbeyondfear.com. All the archived shows are there, as well as the schedule coming up. And it's a wonderful time for this show and the community around it. And I'm very thankful for you. And I hope you find a way to sing. I love Stuart's reminder about going into nature. It matters a great deal for our souls and for breathing. That's so important. So find a way to sing. Take care, everyone. ¶¶